Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello again, dear listeners, and welcome to this next iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff and your host for the series, and I speak with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. My best wishes to you and to you, Orna, for 2023 and all of our colleagues for the Year of the Rabbit. So in this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague and good friend, Orna Rabinovich-Aini. So a few words about you, Orna, for our listeners, and this will also go up on the web with the podcast. Orna is a full professor at Haifa Law Faculty and an expert in ODR, ADR, and the impact of technology on dispute resolution, the relationship between formal and informal justice systems, and particularly, this is where I read you a few years ago, dispute systems design, because what you were doing in that area was really important, maybe come back to that. Published widely in these areas, including the book you co-authored with Ethan Catch on digital justice, technology, and the internet of disputes. I've got a question for you about that one too. And an article you co-authored with Professor J.J. Prescott and Avital Mentovich on litigation outcomes disparities inevitable, courts, technology, and the future of impartiality. I need to know the answer to that question. And that one won an award.
Don't we all? don't we all need to know the answer?
But isn't that just one of our perennial questions? I mean, this is something, it's what brings us into the ADR work. It's what brings us into the ODR work thinking. And it's probably for as long as we've been dealing with disputes in a reasonably organized way, we're never quite sure whether we're getting it right. But that one won an award for the best empirical paper on dispute resolution of 2020 and 2021. Orna has a doctorate in law from Columbia and most recently been awarded a European Research Council grant to study dispute resolution automation. I see. Yeah, right.
I second you.
Right. We've got questions about that.
I still haven't conducted the research, so no answers there. Many questions.
But you can tell us about what your plans and hopes and dreams and fears are. And you also have an Israel Science Foundation grant to study the impact of choice of medium on procedural values and goals. I had a conversation a few weeks ago with Dorcas Quick in Singapore, who's just embarking on a similar project, but focusing on Singapore and the choice of forum and the impact on processes. So it may in due course be useful to compare notes. So I want to thank you for joining us for this podcast. It's great to see you. I get to see you, although the listeners don't, unless you choose to have your video up online as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I mean, just from hearing your comments now during the introduction, I had so many points I hope we'll talk about, you know, just thinking about Dorcas's project. And you mentioned when you talked about disparity, you said, isn't this what it's all about? And I was thinking, I recently wrote a book review of the wonderful book published by our dear friend Jan Martinez and our co-authors on dispute system design, which you also mentioned. And I decided to entitle the review, It's About Justice, because I think, you know, and I remember the wonderful forum you held, and that's what it's all about. It's about justice. And so technology is always in the focus, but it's about justice and how technology.
And technology is going to be a vehicle towards that. But
that's what we hope, right?
Picture we have in mind. And interesting, I think that thread has run through all of the, so far now, 14 conversations I've had. It's in a way, it's what drives us. We hope it's what drives legal systems, but not always. Right. But on that question, can I go back to the title of the book that you wrote with Ethan? How many years ago was that? That was
2017. So it came out before COVID.
If I were in my study and not in my wife's, I'm downstairs because the rest of the house needs to be quiet, but I would show you a copy of your book on the shelves behind me. But my question for you arising out of that book is, what do you or what did you and Ethan mean by digital justice?
Well, I think, you know, I would almost say the book was an exploration of mm-hmm. justice. Our focus was on access to justice. And I always say access to justice is not merely about, you know, in the old days, sliding the papers under the door of the clerk, or in our days, clicking submit, right? It's about yep. the process itself. So it has these two legs. It has access and it has justice. So I think I can speak for both Ethan and myself when I say we have a broad understanding of what access to justice is. Yep. It's not just about the moment of entry, but it's about the type of process that will be conducted mm-hmm. and the types of opportunities one will have as a party conducting such process. And ultimately, it's about the outcomes we mm-hmm. achieve.
So, but there's now a third leg to that, isn't there, which is the digital bit. And right. because, you know, years ago, it was Mauro Capelletti and his colleagues were writing about access to justice and their multi-volume thing. So we're still on that theme. So where in your thinking, your research, because you amongst our colleagues have been thinking about this very deeply, particularly in your design work. What difference does digital make, or what difference do you hope digital can make to the access and the justice?
Well, a long time ago, I think it was Carrie Menkel Meadow who talked about how we romanticize the court, right? So many, many times when we talk about the opportunities that technology holds for access to justice, we hear skepticism and concern and fear, which are all well placed and voices we should be attuned to, but I think maybe it's the status quo bias. There is a lot of concern about change, and to me, technology, I wouldn't say is an excuse, but is almost an excuse to re-envision or reimagine the ways our processes can and do perform. Open up new opportunities, place question marks instead of exclamation marks yep. as to how we conduct things and what is possible. Technology serves us in many different realms in doing so. It serves us as one of the options for conducting processes. They don't have to be all the way through online, by the way. Of course, they can be a hybrid. So you see all those opportunities opening up, but it can also serve us to have a discussion about what types of processes we want to have. And we see how merely designing online processes brings into the process many new voices we never used to listen to when we thought about dispute resolution processes. Mm-hmm. These were sort of just, placed, forced on us top down, right? Designed by, I want to say elderly white men, right?
But I can't disagree with that.
but mostly, obviously, with legal backgrounds, and in recent years, as we start, you know, technology brings with it a world of new concepts and ideas, such as user-centered design, right? That's yep. something we hear a lot. And user-centered design is really about focusing on the user and their needs. And that is the number one, I think, premise for actually enhancing access to justice is actually mm-hmm. looking at the people who need to use the system, hearing those people in their own voices, seeing their reaction to the existing systems or to systems we're thinking of designing, experimenting with these new designs, whether online or offline. We have many new designs that take place on the ground. We can think of problem-solving courts, which are, I think, a wonderful development, at least in certain contexts over the years. And part of what they're committed, by the way, is to ongoing evaluation of their performance and looking at sort of these new metrics. We're not just looking about whether a case was closed or not. I remember when I studied traditional mediation, we used to hear all those settlement rates, right? Yep. And I always tell my students, when I hear 80 to 90% settlement rates, I'm worried. Okay, I think something's going on there. Mm. 50, 60, that sounds sort of right. Maybe in certain cases, maybe in certain very simple cases, you could think of higher rates. But we want to know sort of more fully what's going on there and think about evaluation in a much richer way. And this thinking has begun separate from the evolution of technology. When we look at the field of dispute system design, we look at the work, for example, Lisa Bingham Amsler has done on the USPS redress system, which was, you know, face-to-face mediation, the postal office. They did amazing work on really sort of defining what are the goals and how to examine that. Technology lends itself more easily to learning and evaluation. And so there are opportunities there to find out things we never knew about our dispute resolution processes. But I think, you know, sort of the principles of dispute system design obviously exist even outside the online setting, right? And and we know that the field emerged in the late 80s. You know, it was interesting. I listened to some of Ethan's podcast last night to know sort of what the direction was. And he mentioned that his wonderful book, the Electronic Media and the Transformation of Law, was actually published in 89. And I think the Getting Disputes Resolved, the sort of basic dispute system design book, was also published in that year. So it's kind of interesting to see.
Because that's around about the time, because that came shortly after the Fisher-Urey book.
Right. I think it was late 80s.
Part of that sequence. Yeah. It would have been.
So I'm always interested at looking at these parallels and, you know, discovering they're not parallels and they intersect somewhere.
Just picking up briefly on something you mentioned, your concern or skepticism about settlement rates. Is part of the concern or your thinking that, that to the extent that some mediators, maybe a number of them, are oriented towards settlement, they may be driving settlement because the settlement rates look good, which is what Baruch Bush and Joe Folger were arguing against in the book that came out a little after the other ones you've mentioned, which is that, you know, settlement-driven mediation can miss the point of what mediation can actually do in their promise of mediation. If we're driven by settlement and that leads us down the wrong tracks, or driven by other expectations of what mediation can do, what are the risks with technology when we introduce technology into the process?
So I think the main risk with technology for me is the drive for efficiency, which is kind of, you see how the settlement goes in there. So technology ideally has the potential, I think, and that's sort of been a premise that I've been grappling with in my research. I think that when it is properly designed and introduced to the appropriate context, it has the potential to enhance both efficiency and justice and fairness, right? But when we're focused on efficiency as a sole driving goal and value, then it may trump our other goals and values. So in a sense, it actually makes it makes sense to look at the efficiency goals and to measure them, but they cannot be the driving force for the adoption of technology. Sure. And I think one of the great things about the adoption of online dispute resolution in courts was that it actually preceded COVID. And the systems that were developed in sort of the middle of the second decade of the 21st century, right around 2015, 16, right there before even some of them started in 2013, they were really driven by access to justice concerns. And you can see it everywhere. And we were lucky that the people who were involved in the field, were involved in the design, cared about these issues. They were committed to these issues. Of course, they had to interact with court personnel who are worried and concerned about caseload, rightfully so. We don't want to say that efficiency doesn't matter. It matters. But could also sort of put their foot down and bring all the knowledge they have about the significance of focusing on these other goals alongside efficiency. Otherwise, we're just left with a, you know, quick processing machine. I'd like to say another thing about sort of how you started the discussion. For me, we could even call it abusive mediation. Not all high closure rates connote abusive mediation, but for me, abusive mediation was actually the drive towards ODR. So I always say the most significant experience I had was that in my mediation training, you know, there's a first phase where you do this training with simulations, and then you actually meet co-mediate with experienced mediators. And I co-mediated together with another friend who's actually a colleague these days, with a sort of very experienced court mediator. And we had a very troubling experience. We actually saw him pound on the table when parties didn't want to reach an agreement. Mm. One time I was sitting in the room and he was trying to, you know, we got to an agreement and the parties were supposed to sign the agreement. And I noticed that one of the parties actually had tears dropping sort of on her cheek. And I said to him, you know, this is unethical. I'm not going to sign her. Get her to sign the agreement while she's crying. You know, we need to stop. We need to have a caucus. We need to see what's going on. And I was the quality control. I later brought this up with someone, and this was taken care of. But for me, it was quite a shock because I was amazed with the potential of mediation as a process. I was fully in favor. I was a mediation optimist. And seeing this side of mediation, while surely not prevalent, but we could see how there could be there was a danger of sliding from being efficiency driven to being a little bit too pushy towards settlements. And seeing that got me thinking about confidentiality in mediation, the practices we adopt, treating confidentiality as an all or nothing state. And at the time, I was writing my dissertation in the US. It was late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, I knew I wanted to do dispute resolution. I wasn't a technology buff, so technology wasn't on my radar. But in those years, you know, you had the institutionalization of mediation, which was happening full steam, but you also had the spread of the internet. And at the time, these two phenomena were intersecting sort of only in the e-commerce sphere.
Yeah.
And we couldn't imagine what is happening today, obviously. You know, to get online, I don't need to tell you this. We were both getting on our computers, using a modem. We were online, right? We weren't just using our phones. Yes. So it was a whole separate, it was cyberspace. It was a separate space, right? And then when I started thinking about online dispute resolution, I couldn't imagine it would spread much wider than those online arenas. And I couldn't imagine our lives would change so dramatically. But what I did think we could do was look at this almost as a playground, an area that's not subject to the same rules we are, right? Almost like going to space, right? And being in a spaceship. And using that experience to rethink how we do things offline. So if, for example, online, we looked at the fact that information is documented, exchanges are documented automatically as a disadvantage, as something that sort of makes it less private and may actually cause some people to worry about documentation of information. You know, how in mediation, the mediators always say, don't worry, the notes are for me, I'm going to destroy them once we're out, no one has documentation, whatever. So for me, that was actually an opportunity. And I think in all of my work, what I do is I look at these unique qualities of new technologies. And now, as we talked about, we don't talk about a technology, we talk about a plethora of options, each with their own qualities and opportunities. And I look at those qualities and try to think of how they can improve our dispute resolution processes on the axes of both fairness and efficiency, right? So we want to look at those both. And it may very well be that there are contexts in which, you know, efficiency may be enhanced, but fairness, well, maybe it's not so accessible, but maybe it's a context in which, you know, business owners need to connect with an authority and they have access. So it's not so bad if that setting places more emphasis on the value of efficiency. Actually, in a research project that Ayelet Sela and I conducted recently, we looked at the tribunal in Israel that was that awarded COVID-related compensation to businesses. And it they wanted to evaluate the proceedings because, of course, post-COVID, the idea is to make many more tribunals, to have many more tribunals operate online. Why this is potentially good for the authorities, it's clear, but it can be very good for the people who need to use such services as well. They conducted a process, the first phase of which was a written exchange of documents, you know, not some fancy ODR process that was designed with pro se litigants in mind, but just, you know, document exchange. Some of the cases were decided on the documents, and some of them proceeded to Zoom hearing phase. And the idea was to sort of see what we could learn about the process in general and about these different procedural avenues as well. And you know, and we could see that most of the people actually accessed the Zoom when they had a Zoom session from their office through a computer. And we know these statistics, this is very different from what's happening in cases where you have, for example, landlord-tenant. Oops. You see, so this was Siri picking up. Let me make sure. So technology is always listening, folks. Be careful.
That was Siri talking to you?
Siri picked up on something I said. I didn't put flight mode, so we need to be very careful.
And I hope Siri turned off everything. I don't want to listen to it.
And that's a good idea. That's a good idea. And you know, we talked about the benefits of sort of taking a step back on confidentiality, but there are also the drawbacks and obviously the exposure that comes with digital technology. But to finish the story, so what we could see was that there was a high level of access for business owners. This was compensation for business owners. Yeah. So of course you did have a wide range of businesses from your sort of, a graphic designer working from home, right? Or a plumber a multi-million dollar business, right? Running tourism, you know, whatever. But this is very different from what happened in landlord-tenant cases, for example, in the US, or obviously in criminal cases where you had people under arrest. And these people found it very difficult even to conduct what I before called the sort of very preliminary stage of access. And I think for us, the ODR folks, it was amazing to see during COVID what happened when video came in, right? Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if our listeners know this, but ODR began as an asynchronous text-based process and continues to a large degree. And I think there are questions within our community to what extent what's happening with remote proceedings, as Richard Susskind called them, right? The video, the Zoom or video-based proceedings that take place in courts and elsewhere, and whether they constitute what we call ODR. So under my definition, they do. I mean, for me, every use of technology, including hybrid processes, right, would be part of what I would call online dispute resolution processes, but they would have different qualities, advance a different set of goals or values, and would perform differently across contexts. So I mentioned the word context because that's probably one of the most important words, I think, and that's something I learned from the ADR field, right? Sure. So we can't be, maybe we can call that technology, we should refrain from, I think I put that in a recent paper, from technology imperialism. So thinking we have one solution and apply it across all these different settings.
Well, I guess,
I've talked a lot.
No, that is absolutely perfect. I mean, it's better than me rabbiting on. But the point you're making, one of the many points you're making, is that we could see ODR as encompassing the whole field, of from the most simple form of, simple is probably the wrong word, but if one merely migrates one's offline practice on online, that's ODR. And for many people, that's as much ODR as they're ever going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I certainly saw that with many mediation colleagues during the pandemic. They, including people who had announced very loudly that there was absolutely no future for digital technology in mediation, because mediation is see the whites of their
cold
eyes.
Cold and distant, yeah.
You've got to be right there. But the moment the pandemic happened, they became experts in ODR, but have returned for many good reasons.
But I do want to jump in there and just say one thing. So for me, that's an example of assumptions we make. It's true that for some people, there's nothing like sitting in a room and feeling the silence and looking in the eyes. I think for other people, many times people from marginalized groups, actually, when we think about access to justice, there is nothing more intimidating than that. Absolutely. So that's also something we need to keep in mind. Sorry.
Yep. No. That's a nice way of sort of closing that loop, because what's goes back to your key word of your last comments about the more we see the complexities of dispute resolution, it's not just ODR, the more we understand dispute resolution, the more we think that context matters so much. And this is going back to Frank Sanders, you know, fitting the forum to the fuss and recognizing that this is what allows us to do that. And I'm sure there's a history of this to be written somewhere, that, you know, dispute resolution used to be about the rule of the king and what the king said.
Yeah.
That was, and then it was the rule of law, and then it was applying to, you know, we became more specific to context. So we had criminal cases, family cases, commercial cases. So they're divided into their little silos. Where we're going now is being much more nuanced and much more focused on the particular needs of the disputants, which presumably, I shouldn't presume, here's the question. Is that sort of transition towards focus on the disputant part of what's emerging from your work on design?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, there's a question there, how far we take it. There's a great paper I recommend by Yelitsela that's actually about that, about how really sort of tailoring the interface to the users, to the, you know, the level, like really specific tailoring. So that's worth reading. But yeah, I think we've been seeing this shift, which is occurring, I think, beyond technology. Technology, again, is a sort of tool for doing this shift, for moving from these sort of comprehensive, trans, substantive procedural processes to trying to create more diverse fora for addressing disputes. We see that within courts. You know, in Israel now, we have specialized family courts, and we have labor tribunals, employment and labor tribunals. So we've had these sort of structures in place, but I'm not sure people looked at them from a dispute system design perspective. Yeah. And, you know, and when you think about, you know, there are many critiques of the Lord Wolf reform in England, but you do think about these sort of the attempt to create these dispute specific protocols. So it's there. But I think what technology allows us again to do further is to create many more options, which are important. It provides us tools, and I would even say a framework for understanding what different groups or different individuals need, right? And that's the sort of user system design and the methodologies that go with that kind of approach. And it gives us really important tools for studying the impact of these changes and whether our assumptions are correct or not. And even if they are correct at a given point in time, we know that reality is changing. We know that our possibilities are changing. So dispute system design is sort of a never-ending task, right? It's never linear. You never have an endpoint. Can sort of drive you crazy when you think about it this way, but you need
to put your career path wide open. But is there a risk? I mean, I'm going to do the sort of take the oppositional view. Let me raise a question. Isn't there a risk, or is there a risk of the fragmentation of dispute systems if what we do is take Frank Sanders' notion as far as we possibly can about fitting the form to the fuss or to the fuss makers? And say, you know, your particular needs, we can design dispute processes around that. How do we balance? I mean, you've talked about the efficiency, fairness balance. How do we, whether we're talking technology or not, how do we balance the
sort of public interest sharing
resources against the you know, when I started in law school, and I kid you not, sometime in the middle of last century, the sort of ideal was that the law applies to everybody, and in culturally fractious environments also there's a view that there's a risk of diminishing the unity of a legal system, unity of dispute resolution processes by designing individualized processes. I have no idea what the answer is here, and I depend on you entirely to find that balance between the individualization processes and the need for some sense of coherence and social cohesion.
Right. So I have a few thoughts, and I'm going to sort of, I obviously haven't given this deep thought, but I'm going to adopt a sort of pragmatist approach and also maybe say something a little deeper as we go on. So first of all, we need to be aware of the fact that there's very little public dispute resolution going on today. People might go to court, but we know that a minuscule percentage, we're talking about less than 5% often in some systems and less than 10% in many of the systems that actually end up with a formal court decision following a full-fledged process. So that's the exception. It doesn't make it unimportant, but we should recognize that the reality, even before technology was sort of widely adopted in courts, that's what's been going on. For me, in a sense, technology actually offers the opportunity to reintroduce the public into dispute resolution. Because what we've seen over the last few years is this erosion of the different dichotomies that have shaped the field of dispute resolution, right? The public, private, formal, informal. And you could see that even when I discussed about what confidentiality means, it's so much more complex when you talk about it online. So things are less dichotomous, but one of the things we've been seeing as ODR has been introduced into court is that we've used technology to redesign the formal court process. And it doesn't necessarily mean to privatize it, but to make it more accessible and hopefully make it more fair. So sometimes along the way, you can divert to a private process. You don't have to use a private process, and maybe the mere introduction of technology can alleviate some of the concerns that have made private processes necessary. I still think, I'm still a mediation fan, and I still think there is room and significance to conducting these these processes. But I think that actually if we redesign some of our processes around technology, we could also free up face-to-face mediation, not to be so concerned about the need to close right. cases and reduce the caseload. So I guess what I'm saying is that we do need a sort of base of cases that are addressed publicly and create the shadow of the law that we all are familiar with in Mnookin and Kornhauser's famous 1970s article, one of the classics. And that shadow has been shrinking over the years. And I actually see the potential of technology to give it more room and to rethink the ways in which we give voice to other types of outcomes that occur in the system. Again, as we use online cases and online systems, they are more amenable to being open to the public. So, you know, there was this discussion during COVID, are the processes going to be open or not? Are people going to be able to get a Zoom link and watch them or recording afterwards? We know that very few people actually attend court, right? And attend open court. It's still important that it's open, but very few people do. And there are also opportunities here. So, you know, I worry, I'm certainly not technology. So I'm not blinded by the possibilities of technology. And I think I've always been very cautious, but I've also been wary of our tendency to, I guess, to romanticize the existing system. The system has many problems, one of which is, for example, not only when we do have public decisions, we know that there is a phenomenon of outcome disparities, which means that certain groups consistently fare worse than other groups. When you look at the same types of cases and outcomes should have been similar. Of course, there is discretion. So we don't mean, when we say outcome disparities, we don't mean that all judges should reach the same conclusion or the same outcome. Mm-hmm. But what we do mean is that we don't want these diversions and differences to comport with group distinctions. So for example, race or gender among disputes. So you mentioned earlier, one of the research projects I've been engaged with is with JJ Prescott and Avital, or Tali Mentovich, as we know her. And that was a very exciting process, because really a project, because it connected the dots and showed how under certain dispute system design of online systems in a particular context, you could reduce and in fact eliminate outcome disparities. We looked there at traffic cases, compared outcomes reached face-to-face with those reached online in a written asynchronous process. So there was no video, not even audio. So judges probably could not figure out the race. There were names, but we saw there were clear outcome disparities in the face-to-face context. That's not novel, that's well documented. And of course, echoes disparities that exist in the police and prosecution and all along the way. And these were actually eliminated in those courts under that specific design. And it is not to say that technology is a cure-all, a panacea, not at all. It shows that under appropriate design, and when you actually conduct research to evaluate, you might be able to find this potential and then think about whether this same design would work in another context. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm aware of your earlier stated time constraints and just keeping an eye on the time. But just picking up on that last point and on one of your areas of research, we haven't got time to go into a detail. Is there scope in your thinking for the use of automation in an AI to eliminate those outcome disparities, or to find or manage the balance between fairness and efficiency you mentioned before. What are you an automation optimist?
So here again, I'm cautious. We know, you know, initially everyone was optimistic that we would cure the problems of the human black box with the AI black box.
Yep.
And we now know that of course these systems replicate many of the biases we are familiar with from the human context to that context as well. And in fact, sometimes make it quite difficult to detect and more difficult to try to systematically think how to prevent these types of biases. The project, and this actually connects well with what we talked about before, actually connects this notion of increasing automation, which I think is inevitable. We're all following ChatGPT, and you know, my kids come home from school and tell me they've discovered it. So we talk about ethics, and you know, but you know, 10-year-olds are using it all the time. So, and they really don't understand why we need to do everything on our own.
And when you've got Siri, why do you need to know anything?
Exactly. Well, she's off now. So connecting this phenomenon with the other phenomenon we discussed of the vanishing trial, what this project that I'm about to embark on will look at is actually what's happening under the shadow in terms of automation. So we're all of us are very sort of, I mean, the hype is about automated decision making, but part of what I said here in my proposal was that there's a lot of automation already occurring in the shadow of decision making. Right. And we want to know what's happening there. So I see automation taking over a lot of the functions that humans as judges or mediators or arbitrators have performed in the pre sort of decision making phase. And I think that's also something we need to sort of figure out and understand what's going on there, aside from actual decision making. And again, I think our answers are going to be context specific and are going to have to be driven by research-based findings.
Yeah. Which I guess is what you'll be doing on the next part of your sabbatical and pursuing that research. So at some point, of course, you're going to unleash that on the world. But Aura, I'm aware that you've talked about your time constraints, so we should wrap up. I've loved this conversation. I enjoy them all.
Oh, me too. It was so much fun. And seeing you was the best part.
It's great catching up again. And again, this is where the technology is so wonderful.
It allows us
to do this. So I really do appreciate your taking the time and your willingness to join in these conversations. And I don't know whether you're going to India for the next conference. I won't be able to make it.
I don't know, because I'm on sabbatical, as you mentioned. So I really want to go. It's going to be painful if I don't go.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's really, anyone who can go should go. It promises to be one of the best.
It sure does, but because I don't belong to any institution anymore, there's no sabbatical research funding or anything like that, and it's quite expensive to get there. But I can watch from afar and imagine, because having been to India a couple of times and would love to go back, but probably not this time. But we should wrap. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast has been brought to you by iCoder, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about iCoder or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.